So I'm Barb Armacost, and I am moderating the panel this afternoon. On behalf of the Law Christian Fellowship, the Federalist Society, and the Lambda Law Alliance, I'd like to welcome you to this panel discussion of the Supreme Court's opinion in Christian Legal Society versus Martinez. The sponsors of this event have aptly called the panel CLS versus Martinez, When Fundamental Rights Collide. I think that's a good title. We have on our panel today three distinguished experts on First Amendment issues concerning church and state. Two of our panelists were directly involved in the litigation of the CLS case, and all have litigated multiple cases involving constitutional religious rights. Let me first give a brief introduction to each of the panelists, then I'll get us started by providing a brief background of the facts of the CLS versus Martinez case, and then I'll turn the program over to the panelists. Our first panelist to my right is Kim Colby. Ms. Colby represented the Christian Legal Society in CLS versus Martinez. She is senior counsel for the Christian Legal Society's Center for Law and Religious Freedom. The center's mission is to address discrimination targeted at religious student groups, faith-based social services organizations, religious healthcare professionals, and religious schools. Ms. Colby graduated summa cum laude from Illinois University with a major in American history. She earned her J.D. from Harvard Law School in 1981. Ms. Colby has been litigating cases for the Christian Legal Society's Center for Law and Religious Freedom for nearly 20 years. She has represented religious groups in numerous appellate cases, including two cases heard by the Supreme Court. In addition, she was instrumental in the passage of the Federal Equal Access Act, which protects the right of secondary school students to hold religious meetings on campus. Our second panelist, Mr. Scott Ballinger. Mr. Ballinger is one of our own, a double who graduated from the university in 1993 and from the law school in 1996. While he was here, Ballinger wowed us in the classroom. He also served as articles development editor on the Virginia Law Review. After graduating, Mr. Ballinger clerked for Chief Judge Clifford Wallace on the Ninth Circuit Court of Appeals, and then for Justice Antonin Scalia on the U.S. Supreme Court. He then spent 1 year at the Department of Justice before joining the law firm of Latham & Watkins, where he is now a partner. Mr. Ballinger has worked on a number of high-profile cases in the Supreme Court, including representing the University of Michigan in Grutter versus Bollinger. Mr. Ballinger argued two cases before the Supreme Court last term. Latham & Watkins took over the representation of Martinez when cert was granted in the Supreme Court, and Mr. Ballinger was deeply involved with writing the brief in that case. Last but not least is our own Professor Doug Laycock, who is the Armistead M. Dobie Professor of Law, the Horace W. Goldsmith Research Professor of Law, and Professor of Religious Studies at the University. Professor Laycock is one of the nation's authorities on law and religious liberty. Before joining the faculty at the law school, Professor Laycock served as the Yale Kamisar Collegiate Professor of Law at the University of Michigan School of Law. Prior to that, he taught for 25 years at the University of Texas and for 5 years at the University of Chicago. Professor Laycock has argued many cases in the courts, including the United States Supreme Court. He's authored over 60 articles and book chapters on religious liberty, co-authored a book of essays entitled Same-Sex Marriage and Religious Liberty, and has published the first volume of a four-volume collection of his many writings on religious liberty. And that's only his scholarship on church and state. Professor Laycock earned his BA from Michigan State University and his JD from the University of Chicago Law School. So let me begin by introducing the case of CLS versus Martinez. The story involves Hastings Law School and a group of Christian students. A Christian group called the Hastings Christian Legal Society and later the Hastings Christian Fellowship had existed for some 10 years before the events that gave rise to this litigation. The group had been officially recognized by Hastings Law School as a registered student organization. The Registered Student Organization, or RSO, program at Hastings is very similar to the program at UVA for contract independent organizations. Like UVA, Hastings Law School encourages students to form extracurricular associations that contribute to the Hastings community experience. Hastings does this through its RSO program, which extends official recognition to school groups, student groups, and grants them access to law student funds and facilities. RSOs can apply for financial assistance to subsidize group activities. The money comes out of a fund derived from a mandatory student activity fee imposed on students. RSOs also have access to channels for communicating with students, such as through official emails, a weekly Office of Student Services newsletter, postings on official bulletin boards, and participating in an annual student organizations fair. RSOs can also apply for permission to use law school facilities for meetings and office space. Finally, they can use the Hastings Law School's name and logo. In 2004, the existing Christian group decided to associate itself with a national organization called the Christian Legal Society. CLS is a nationwide association of lawyers, law students, law professors, and judges who share a common faith and seek to honor Jesus Christ in the legal profession. Reading from the petitioner's brief in the Supreme Court, quote, CLS provides opportunities for fellowship and moral and spiritual guidance for Christian lawyers, encourages and mentors Christian law students, promotes justice, religious liberty, and biblical conflict resolution, and encourages lawyers to furnish legal services for the poor, end quote. CLS maintains attorney and law student chapters across the country. Although CLS meetings themselves are open to all students, voting members and leaders of the group are required to affirm their commitment to the group's core beliefs by signing the CLS Statement of Faith and pledging their lives accordingly, pledging to live their lives accordingly. Voting members are entitled to do such things as vote on chapter policies and programs, vote for leaders, and stand for election to these positions. The Statement of Faith, required to be included in the bylaws of CLS student chapters, includes a series of affirmations about faith in God, faith in Jesus Christ and the Holy Spirit, and in the Bible as the Word of God. It also includes a promise to live according to certain moral precepts, including abstaining from sexual conduct outside of marriage between a man and a woman. The national organization was explicit that this affirmation includes abstaining from homosexual as well as heterosexual sex. In 2004, the new CLS chapter at Hastings Law School submitted an application for RSO status, accompanied by all required documents, including the set of bylaws required by CLS National. The application was denied on the ground that the chapter's new bylaws violated Hastings' anti-discrimination policy. CLS asked for an exemption from the anti-discrimination policy, but this request was denied. In October 2004, CLS filed suit against Hastings Law School under 42 U.S.C. 1983. Its complaint alleged that Hastings' refusal to grant the organization RSO status violated CLS's First and Fourth Amendment rights to free speech, freedom of association, and free exercise of religion. The suit sought injunctive and declaratory relief. Now, one of the issues that was in dispute and remained a point of disagreement in the Supreme Court's opinion was precisely what was Hastings' policy on non-discrimination. Hastings' written policy read in pertinent part, and I quote it to you, "The University of California, Hastings College of Law, shall not discriminate unlawfully on the basis of race, color, religion, national origin, ancestry, disability, age, sex, or sexual orientation. This non-discrimination policy covers admissions, access, and treatment in Hastings-sponsored programs and activity," end quote. Later, however, in a deposition, the dean of Hastings Law School stated that Hastings interpreted and applied its non-discrimination policy as requiring that every organization must permit any student to be a member and to participate if the student wished. This policy became known as the, quote, all-comers policy. CLS has continued to argue that the actual policy as enforced by Hastings Law School was not an all-comers policy, but the non-discrimination policy as written. To make matters more complicated, however, the parties stipulated to the following factual assertion in the lower courts, and I read it to you. Hastings requires that registered student organizations allow any student to participate, become a member, or seek leadership positions in the organization, regardless of her status or beliefs. Thus, for example, the Hastings Democratic Caucus cannot bar students holding Republican political beliefs from becoming members or seeking leadership positions in the organization, end quote. The Supreme Court decided the case based on this stipulation. In other words, the court considered the constitutionality of the non-discrimination policy as Hastings Law School said it was being applied. The dissent took the view that the written non-discrimination policy ought to govern, and the dissent would have decided the case on that ground. Unfortunately, this means that to a great extent, the two opinions are a bit like ships passing in the night. With that introduction, I'll turn the panel over to Ms. Kim Colby.
Well, thank you very much for that introduction and for having this panel and all the hard work that I know has gone into it. I want to pick up with a little bit about the description of CLS, because I did want to emphasize that we have been fighting for the right of student religious groups on university and high school campuses to meet for prayer and Bible study and worship for about 30 years now. It's been a long battle. And for a long time, the battle was about whether or not the Establishment Clause required universities to exclude religious groups from campus. And when that part of the battle was basically won, although that argument is still made some today, it seemed that the emphasis for keeping religious groups off of some campuses shifted to using non-discrimination policies to exclude the religious groups. Now, to me, this seems like a perverse use of a non-discrimination policy because, after all, most non-discrimination policies claim to be protecting religious students among other beneficiaries of the policy. And so to use a non-discrimination policy to exclude a religious group seems to actually be acting contrary to what a non-discrimination policy is about. I also wanted to note that CLS has not only protected religious students' rights over the years, but as Barbara mentioned, we were instrumental in passage of the Equal Access Act in 1984, which protected the rights of high school students to meet for religious, political, philosophical, and other speech. And if you look at the case law, you will see that the cases are pretty much evenly divided between evangelical Christian student groups going to court under the Equal Access Act to protect their right to meet, and gay student groups to go to court and protect their right to meet when they run into a hostile school administration. And CLS is actually very proud of the fact that we are protecting not only religious groups, but also the gay student groups' right to speak, because we truly believe that the broadest interpretation and protection of the First Amendment is what's best for all of us. With that being said, I was asked to give basically a brief overview of the arguments that we relied on in the Supreme Court. And that's going to take probably more time than I have, so I'll just get started and we'll see where we go. But Martinez, I think, in one sentence, is a case in which the Supreme Court's liberal bloc and Justice Kennedy lost faith in the First Amendment. I think had the First Amendment been applied faithfully, and the Supreme Court's precedent about free speech and freedom of association, that everyone would have won. Everyone would be on campus, everyone would be saying what they wanted to say, and no one would be excluded. Instead, Justice Ginsburg, writing for the majority, ruled that CLS could be excluded from campus under the unusual all-comers policy that Hastings had. And in doing so, Justice Ginsburg begins her opinion in a way in which I keep trying to decide if she's incredibly honest or slightly disingenuous, because she begins her opinion by saying, and I'm paraphrasing, but I think it's a fair paraphrase, that there are three cases that would seem to indicate that CLS should win, but CLS doesn't. And those three cases are Healy versus James, Widmar versus Vincent, and University of Virginia versus Rosenberger. I'm going to go through those cases very quickly so that hopefully I can get to tell you why Justice Ginsburg ignores the basic holdings of those cases. Healy versus James is a 1972 case in which students at a public college in Connecticut wanted to start a Students for Democratic Society chapter. And Students for Democratic Society chapter back in the 60s was known for sometimes acting in violent ways on campus. The campus president said, no, I will not recognize you. The case went to the Supreme Court, and the Supreme Court held that official recognition of a student group was a very important First Amendment right. The school said, we don't want to give them our approval because that's an emblem we don't want to recognize them because that's giving them a stamp of approval to their ideas. And the Supreme Court said, no, it's not. Instead, official recognition gives a student group the right to meet on campus formally, to reserve rooms, to have priority access. It also gives the student group the right to use channels of communication. Back in the Healy day, that was bulletin boards and kiosks. Now it's websites and blast emails and student activity fairs. But these are very important for a group to maintain a presence on campus. And the Supreme Court said that this group had a free speech and free association right to be recognized, and that the government had a heavy burden to justify its denial of recognition. Then we move along, and as I said, religious groups started being pushed off campuses because of the Establishment Clause. And in Widmar versus Vincent, the University of Missouri had excluded a religious group because the university thought that by allowing the religious group to use its classrooms and its bulletin boards and its heat and its light, that was subsidizing religion, that was endorsing religion, and that would violate the Establishment Clause. The Supreme Court said two things. First, it said the religious group, in that case they were called Cornerstone, has a free speech right, just like in Healy, to be officially recognized, to have access to classrooms and to channels of communication. And that right applies to religious speech just like any other type of speech. And the Establishment Clause is not violated because this is not the government's religious speech. This is a private group's religious speech. And most importantly for this case that we're discussing today, they said, just because you let a group meet, just because you give it recognition, you're not endorsing its speech. You're not subsidizing it. You're just treating it fairly. And that goes very much to what we're going to discuss today. The final case that Ginsburg said really isn't going to be applied here is University of Virginia versus Rosenberger back in 1995. And in that case, a young student named Scott Rosenberger decided he wanted to publish a magazine about campus issues, racism and eating disorders and a bunch of other things, from a Christian, evangelical Christian perspective. And he was already, I think, a recognized student group, a CIO, but he looked around and he realized about 16 publications were getting funding from the Student Activity Fee Fund administered by the university. And he went to the university officials and he said, I would like to get $5,000 in order to publish my monthly magazine about my views, evangelical Christian views on a bunch of issues. And the university officials said over Mr. Jefferson's dead body, well, we give you $5,000 to promote your evangelical Christian beliefs. The case went to the Supreme Court, and again, the court said there's a free speech right here under Widmar and Healy, and the Establishment Clause is not violated even by funding to the tune of about $5,000 evangelical Christian speech. So anyway, what does Justice Ginsburg then, in her own opinion, do? Well, she sets these three opinions aside, and she says those are all about viewpoint discrimination, and viewpoint discrimination is not going on here. But there are some important lessons here that she just ignores. The first one obviously being that the denial of recognition is a heavy burden on speech. Justice Ginsburg says there's really not a burden. CLS can meet informally. She makes all the arguments that the college made in Healy that the Supreme Court rejected in Healy. She also ignores the fact that the government has a heavy burden. We would call it strict scrutiny now when it denies recognition to a group. Instead, she says it just has to satisfy a reasonable test, a reasonableness test. She also ignores the fact that Widmar and Healy and Rosenberger all are saying that by giving official recognition to a student group, you're not endorsing its speech. Giving it classroom space and communication channels and funding is not subsidizing the viewpoint of that group. It's just treating the group fairly. Finally, she makes the argument that one of the reasons that it's reasonable for Hastings to exclude CLS from campus is that Hastings does not want to appear to be approving of CLS's conduct. Well, the conduct at issue is the religious criteria for leadership, which is really expression. It's not conduct. And we thought that when Hastings made that argument that they were in effect admitting that they were engaged in viewpoint discrimination, which would violate Widmar and Rosenberger. But Justice Ginsburg just glosses over that. And finally, we would say that the right of religious groups to be on campus is that's protected in Widmar and Rosenberger is fairly toothless if it means that in order to be on campus, religious groups have to give up their right to have their leaders agree with their religious beliefs.
I'm honored to be here, though. I should say a couple of things up front. One is that I'm not here formally representing Hastings Law School anymore. I was honored to do that, but I don't speak for them anymore. The other is that I'm way out of my depth on this panel as an expert in religious liberty or religious constitutional issues. I'm sort of a general purpose constitutional lawyer, and I've had a couple of these cases, but I feel humbled by my company up here. Before this case, my principal involvement in these issues was actually as a defendant in Rosenberger versus Rector and Visitor at the University of Virginia, because I was the student member on the board at the time, and my best friend was the student council president who denied Ron Rosenberger his funding. At the time, I had a lot more sympathy for the university's establishment clause arguments than the doctrine has borne out, but that's just how things go. There's an awful lot to say about this case, in part because of Professor Armacost's observation that there are really sort of three CLS versus Martinez cases. There's the case that the court chose to decide, and then there are sort of the two cases that CLS urged the court to decide and that the court declined. I'm inclined to talk about at least first the case that the court actually decided, and then maybe we can circle back on the other issues to the extent they make sense. So the case was decided in the Supreme Court on the stipulation that Hastings's policy is that essentially every student group has to take all comers without regard to status and belief. That caveat is a little important because it's not quite exactly that every student group has to take anyone who wants to join, but you can't discriminate on the basis of status and belief. And, I think I agree with Ms. Colby that, in the end, as a doctrinal matter, this case really came down to how the Supreme Court was going to read Healy versus James and Widmar versus Vinson. There is a strong ripple, to be fair, in Healy and Widmar, to the effect that that exclusion of student groups from campus is special. And should be regarded as something like a traditional forum for speech, like a public park or a public street, and therefore, sort of viewed in strict scrutiny terms and time, place, and manner terms, instead of under the court's limited forum precedents. And, you can see, Justice Alito in dissent in the CLS case quotes Healy for the idea that for students, the campus is their world. And so it's sort of disingenuous to speak about school recognition of student groups as if it was a limited forum issue. It's really sort of more of a traditional forum issue. Justice Kennedy's opinion for the Supreme Court in the Rosenberger case, also citing Healy, sort of waxes poetic about the special dangers of suppressing student speech in a university environment. So there is this sense in the cases that student group recognition has always been a sort of special love of the Supreme Court, and that maybe the court wasn't going to be prepared to strictly enforce its limited forum precedents, if pushed in a student recognition case. And the lesson of what really happened in CLS versus Martinez is that the court stuck to its guns on what the limited forum doctrine seems to require, instead of carving out, either a special exception for student groups on university campuses or recognizing that a university campus is, in some sense, always a traditional forum for speech because of the unique role of universities in our intellectual tradition. The court could have gone that way, but ultimately, Justice Kennedy, who is, no small friend of academic freedom and the First Amendment, just wasn't persuaded here. So if you are actually trying to apply the court's limited public forum precedents, I actually think this is a pretty straightforward case. This is not a general regulatory requirement like the New Jersey public accommodations law that the court considered in Boy Scouts versus Dale, where New Jersey was telling Boy Scouts, look, you have to take gay scoutmasters, and you know, if you don't like it, you're in violation of New Jersey law. This is a discretionary government forum or subsidy program, which CLS is free to join or not join. And the condition was on condition in on participation in a discretionary government program. And in that context, which the court calls limited public forum doctrine, the rule has always been that the government can open up its own property or facilities as a forum for private speech and can impose limitations on what participants in that forum can do, so long as those limitations are not viewpoint-based and are reasonable in light of the purposes of the forum. Content discrimination is okay in a limited public forum. The university can say, we're going to open a forum for, you know, the discussion of Greek philosophers. And, you know, if you come in and you want to talk about basketball, the university can kick you out. But they can't impose viewpoint-based limitations. I mean, they can't say, we're going to open a forum for the discussion of Greek philosophers, and anybody who thinks, you know, Plato's cave is a stupid analogy isn't allowed to participate. So that's the basic doctrine. And if you were going to hold, you know, Hastings's all-comers policy up against that doctrine, you know, Justice Ginsburg marches through and says, you know, clearly this is a viewpoint-neutral policy. There's nothing viewpoint discriminatory about saying that every group has to take all comers without regard to status or belief. And indeed, the court has repeatedly over a long period of time held that non-discrimination laws regulating exclusion from groups regulate conduct, not speech at all. And as for the reasonableness of the policy in light of the purposes of the forum, you know, Hastings said that this policy ensures that the public funds and the university's own name are not used to support conduct that the university and the people of California are entitled to disapprove of. CLS says passionately and makes a very strong case, I think, that there is not any a moral equivalence of any kind between a religious group's desire to discriminate on the basis of religion and, you know, non-religious groups' desire to discriminate on the basis of religion, and that's probably right. You know, they make the same case that it's not the same thing when a religious group wants to discriminate on a principled basis, on the basis of sexual orientation, that's not morally equivalent to an employer doing the same thing, and they're entitled to that view. But the people of California are entitled to a different view, and certainly, you know, Hastings is entitled to a different view. And it, you know, it is entitled to think that we don't want to spend our money and have our name associated with conduct, discrimination on the basis of religion and sexual orientation, of which we disapprove. You know, Hastings says this policy is also designed to foster dialogue within groups and to ensure that groups don't act in a cliquish fashion and wall themselves off from dissenting opinions. Justice Kennedy, you know, says in his little concurrence that is a particularly reasonable goal for a law school, because law schools are, of course, in the business of training people in how to interact with disagreement. And, you know, third, an all-comers policy at a university level for a forum of this kind ensures that all students have access to all activities that their own money is going to pay for. The funds for this RSO program come out of student activity fees that all students pay. And there's a sense in which it's reasonable for the university and the other students to say, you know what, we don't want to fund groups that won't let us participate. And if, you know, CLS is given license to exclude some students, then presumably, you know, other groups can exclude whoever they want to. And, you know, I think this is a big deal as a practical matter, not because there are lots of groups that are poised to discriminate on the basis of religion or sexual orientation, but because students are naturally cliquish animals and, you know, inclined to exclude people that they don't get along with. So, you know, the idea that I've always had in my head is, you know, what if the outdoor club at the University of Virginia you know, comes to be dominated by a group of people who just really like hanging out together on Friday night and share, you know, common beliefs and attributes, and, you know, enjoy spending university money to organize canoeing trips down the James or you know, hiking trips up Mount Rag. And then one day somebody shows up who is just kind of awkward, you know, and it may be that they just don't get along, or maybe this person is prone to expressing views that, you know, the people who are in the group don't really like. You know, maybe that view is that everyone should accept Jesus Christ as their Lord and Savior. You know, whatever it is, those students decide, you know what, we're not going to let you climb Mount Rag with us. And I think the University of Virginia has a legitimate reason to want to say that if you're going to be the official outdoor club at the University of Virginia and you're going to get university money, you should have to let that guy come on your hiking trip. And the last point, I think, on reasonableness is, you know, that an all-comers policy gets the university off the hook for having to evaluate what's a good reason for exclusion and what's a bad reason for exclusion, which is a really big problem. You know, CLS makes a strong case that they have better reasons for excluding, you know, people than my hypothetical about the outdoor club, which is a little bit flip, I agree. But, you know, do university officials want to be in the position of deciding whether, you know, some secular group's reason for excluding some particular student on the basis of their status or belief is, you know, more or less reasonable and commendable than CLS's justifications for doing the same thing? It's hard. It involves, you know, discretion that unnecessarily entangles the school with, you know, potentially questions of religious doctrine. I'm sure we'll hear a lot about that. It's reasonable for the university just to say we want to stay away. So I see I'm down 30 seconds. I'll cut it off there.
Well, this is a little unfair. Professor Armacost apparently didn't know or forgot I filed an amicus brief in the case on behalf of a group of religious minorities, and so I have a view too, and I'll give you a little bit of that, and so Scott's a little bit outnumbered. I'm mostly going to try to put the case in a somewhat larger context. In addition to the student organization cases that Kim Colby mentioned, there is another line of cases that typically go under the rubric of freedom of association about the right of a First Amendment organization, not the outdoor club probably, but a political organization or a religious organization, to control its own membership and to control its own leadership. There are a lot of these cases about political parties. There's the Boy Scouts versus Dale case that Scott mentioned. There are a lot of these cases in the courts of appeals about churches choosing their own ministers. One of those cases is the case I got cert granted on this week. So maybe that rule's about to go away. We'll see. Hope not. And that was another that was another basis for the Christian Legal Society's argument. And so it, in a sense, they presented a fairly bright line rule. It didn't require the university to evaluate a lot of reasons for excluding people. At the heart of CLS's position was to tell a religious organization it can't discriminate on the basis of religion is just a category mistake. Religious organizations are defined by the religious commitments of their members. And this wasn't about conduct so much as it was about identity. You know, can you have an organization that is committed to an idea and organizes itself around that idea and recruits members who support that idea? And other students were free to participate, but they weren't free to vote, and they weren't free to assume leadership positions. Now, there was some description earlier of the three different policies. Why did that matter? The reason it mattered was CLS thought, quite plausibly, that the written policy was viewpoint discriminatory. Because the written policy was a list of the standard civil rights categories, race, sex, religion, national origin, sexual orientation, not politics. Okay? So the political organizations were free to organize around viewpoint. They were free to organize around their idea and insist that their members all support the idea. The young Democrats and the young Republicans could insist on loyalty to their political ideas, but Christian Legal Society could not insist on loyalty to its religious ideas. And so the claim was, you've distinguished political viewpoints from religious viewpoints. You've treated religious viewpoints less favorably, political viewpoints more favorably. And you know, that kind of arose by accident because religion got on the canonical list of civil rights categories and politics never did. It was to avoid that issue, to avoid the viewpoint discrimination challenge, that Hastings announced the all-comers policy. And the trial lawyer for CLS stipulated to it. I've never talked to him. I don't even know his name. I have no idea what he was thinking or why he stipulated to it. I know Scott Belize's client. I have friends at Hastings who were involved on the Hastings side of this case, so I don't say this lightly or happily. It's just not remotely credible. The all-comers policy had never been written down. It had never been announced or explained to the student organizations that were supposed to comply with it. It had never been enforced. There were several student organizations that had viewpoint-based membership exclusions on the face of their constitutions. The constitution was reviewed by the assistant dean. That's how CLS got caught. It was inconsistent with what Hastings said in its answer. In its answer, it says political organizations can insist on loyalty from their members. It was never thought through. It didn't explain organizations with restricted membership, so the belief status thing had to be added to it. That isn't a stipulation. They said you can have exclusions based on conduct, but the CLS rule about unrepentant non-marital sex was not about conduct. That was about status, although it applied to men and women and gays and straights. So CLS said it's just pretext. That's not really the policy. And finally, in the reply brief, Michael McConnell said, well, we stipulated that it exists. We didn't stipulate that it had ever existed before, that it had ever been enforced, that it wasn't a pretext. The Supreme Court left the pretext issue open on remand, and the Ninth Circuit held that it had been waived. But that's what the fight was about over the stipulation. Because if it's really all comers, then the viewpoint discrimination argument kind of goes away. The effect of that is the viewpoint discrimination argument is not resolved in CLS. So CLS provides a safe harbor for schools that want to exclude these religious groups and who are willing to adopt an all-comers policy and to actually enforce it. We're willing to tell the young Democrats you got to admit conservative Republicans and let them be as disruptive as they want. I don't know that many schools are going to be willing to do that. And I don't think any plaintiff's lawyer is ever again going to make the mistake of stipulating that such a policy exists or not challenging whether it's actually being enforced. For the standard form civil rights policy that most campuses have, don't discriminate based on race, sex, religion, national origin, and so forth, that issue remains open. And the question whether it is viewpoint discrimination to apply this to religious groups but not to tell political groups they can't organize around their idea remains open. So that goes to what's decided is in some ways a pretty narrow opinion. What kind of forum is a college campus? Scott alluded to this. There were tantalizing hints in earlier opinions that a college campus might be a traditional public forum for students, faculty, and staff. There was never a holding. They never set it straight out. Widmar versus Vincent, they said it's very much like a traditional public forum, but they didn't say it is a traditional public forum. Now we got a pretty clear holding. It's not a traditional public forum. Campus is a limited public forum, and you get to talk as much as the administration decides to let you talk. I'll put in a good word for you tonight. They can't have viewpoint restrictions, right? They can't say Democrats get to talk and Republicans don't, or vice versa. But they can have content restrictions. They can have these conduct restrictions. They could, you know, my favorite example, which the court threw out as too absurd to be dealt with, is Jews for Jesus versus Los Angeles International Airport. Airport commissioners in L.A. adopted a rule, no First Amendment activity in the airport. And they said, it's perfectly viewpoint neutral. It's kind of like the all-comers policy. I mean, it applies to absolutely everything. And the court says, well, what do you mean? You can't ask the gate attendant a question? You can't read your magazine while you wait for your flight? there's some limit, but there's a lot you can do with viewpoint neutrality. It's consistent with viewpoint neutrality and pretty substantially limiting on free speech. I do not expect that there are going to be dramatic changes in speech rules on campuses, but there are an awful lot of student affairs people who would like to get rid of these conservative religious groups. They've been at it for 30 years, as Kim said, and now they got another way to do it. So the court says this is a limited public campus is a limited public forum. What does that mean? Well, it means that they can have rules that restrict access. One kind of rule they can have are subject matter restrictions. There are subjects you just can't talk about. That was what a lot of those earlier cases were litigated on. Rosenberger v. UVA was litigated that way, Widmar versus Vincent. The argument was religion is a subject matter. And we're saying it's just not a subject matter that's admitted to our forum. Nobody can talk about religion as a student organization or in a reserved room. Pro or con, that's why it's viewpoint neutral. The atheists can't meet any more than the Christian Legal Society can meet. And the court rejected that and said, well, religion may be a subject matter, but religion is also a source of viewpoints, a powerful source of viewpoints and all kinds of things. And by excluding the religious viewpoint, you've engaged in viewpoint discrimination and therefore, even though it's a limited public forum, you've violated the Constitution. So now this is a new way to do it, apply some rule they can't live with, some non-discrimination rule, particularly the religious discrimination, which really goes to the heart of CLS's identity, is now a way to exclude from the limited public forum. The other thing that is new in this opinion is the idea that access to the limited public forum is a subsidy. Justice Ginsburg says the people of California are entitled to decide that we are not going to subsidize this group that discriminates against gay people. That's new. Not that the California can choose what to subsidize and what not to subsidize. That's a very standard idea. The idea that access to the forum is a subsidy is new. They had repeatedly rejected that idea in Establishment Clause cases. The states would say, the campuses would say, we would be subsidizing religion if we let them meet for free in our empty classrooms and turned on the air conditioning. And the court said, no, that's not a subsidy as long as the access is equal. And Rosenberger, even when it was cash, right, going to send a $5,000 check to pay your printing bill, said as long as it's equal access, it doesn't count as a subsidy. Now, the Hastings case says access to the forum is a subsidy. It's a subsidy that justifies attaching whatever conditions the state wants to attach. That feeds into a line of cases about does aid from the government come with strings attached or can it? There must be some limit to what the state can require you to give up in exchange for a subsidy, but we haven't found it yet. The Supreme Court is very deferential that when the government subsidizes something, the government gets to regulate it. So maybe access to the forum is enough of a subsidy to justify attaching regulations, but not enough of a subsidy to violate the Establishment Clause. They didn't say that. Maybe Justice Kennedy believes in that distinction. It's hard to imagine many people believe in that distinction. But anyhow, the idea that access to the forum is a subsidy is new, and it's likely to have consequences down the road. Finally, in two footnotes, 24 and 27, she says, any free exercise claim is obviously precluded by Employment Division versus Smith. Employment Division versus Smith is a case from 1990 that says there is no judicial review under the Free Exercise Clause of rules that are neutral and generally applicable. The neutral and generally applicable law is applied to a religious act, even if it's applied to ban a worship service, which were the facts in Employment Division versus Smith. No standard of justification, no judicial review is required. It's enough that the rule is neutral and generally applicable. That's been controversial, as you can well imagine, but that's the law of the Federal Free Exercise Clause. Justice Ginsburg was not there in 1990. She had never tipped her hand before. We didn't know what she thought. Now we know. She likes Employment Division versus Smith. Sotomayor joined this opinion. Her views were unknown in Employment Division versus Smith. Breyer joined this opinion, although he's criticized. He says it should be reconsidered. He may just be accepting his current law for this application. The two footnotes are ill-considered, and they're almost surely wrong, because this is not a neutral and generally applicable law. It explicitly references religion. The religious organization cannot exclude non-believers from their religion. The theory that Employment Division versus Smith can decide this case doesn't depend on the notion of subsidy, doesn't depend on the notion of limited public forum. It would apply to a church out in the community. You know, California could say churches are places of public accommodation, and they cannot exclude non-believers, and there would be no free exercise claim. Presumably, there would still be a free speech claim based on freedom of association, which they presumably would, hopefully, would treat differently outside the limited public forum rather than inside it. But what they say about the free exercise claim is rather alarming. Justice Stevens, concurring, relies heavily on the theory that a limited forum is limited and it's a kind of subsidy. He says explicitly California could not do this to religious groups in the larger society, and I assume there are more than five votes for that proposition. But the two free exercise footnotes are kind of scary. So going forward, what's the next litigation going to look like? I'm sure CLS is going to have more of this. Kim's been dealing with the reaction to it around the country. My guess is the next case, there won't be a stipulation, and it will actually tee up the question of whether the standard form non-discrimination policy is viewpoint discriminatory in this application, or whether that too is enforceable in the limited public forum. There will be other questions about the subsidy idea, who can be excluded from limited public forums because access is viewed as a subsidy. Someone will undoubtedly try to relitigate that under the Establishment Clause. Pretty clearly, five votes right now to reject the notion that access to subsidy by access to the forum violates the Establishment Clause. But I think we'll see that argument made. And we got some news about free exercise. Employment Division versus Smith has more votes than we knew about.
So we'd like to give each of the two of you 3 or 4 minutes to respond. Tim, you want to go first?
I appreciated what Doug said, and I just wanted to highlight it. I passed out, or had passed out, an article by Adam Goldstein of the Student Law Press Center, who the day after the opinion came out, and I don't think he's a particular ally of CLS, but he was saying that this was the worst decision for students' expression on campus in 22 years. And the article's very... He really takes apart Justice Ginsburg's opinion, in part because she says, well, you've got the internet now, what? That's enough. You don't have to be on campus. You have the internet to use. And he's very troubled by the idea that the internet can now be used to justify further restrictions on free speech. I guess one of the things that puzzled us was, and I think Doug touched on it, was this idea that in trying to make the all-comers policy not as absurd as it is, Hastings began to kind of come up with these restrictions that still could be put on access. And one was dues, and one was attendance requirements, and those kind of make sense. But as Justice Ginsburg accepted in her opinion, the law school is also able to put on any skill-based assessment requirements. And the reason that's there is so that the law review does not have to accept everyone who wants to be on law review. Well, at oral argument, Justice Alito said, well, does that mean that CLS can give a little skill-based assessment of whether someone should be a member of CLS? Like maybe say, here's our statement of faith, discuss why you agree or disagree with it. And opposing counsel said, well, they could, as long as it's an objective test. So this kind of policy is just craziness. And furthermore, I just would emphasize again the fact that both Justice Ginsburg and Hastings said that one of the reasons we should be able to have this policy is because the people of California want to disapprove of CLS, which I don't think there was a referendum on that. I'm not sure how they know what the people of California want, is again an example of why this really was viewpoint discrimination at heart. And Doug, this is beyond what Hastings talks about or Ginsburg, but the viewpoint discrimination test is a very valuable test for protecting free speech, because often you can find viewpoint discrimination. But there are a lot of times when you can't, as Doug was giving an example of. And the problem with viewpoint discrimination, its weakness, is that it really skews the debate in favor of the status quo. Because if you think about it, the people who need to have access to a forum to speak, to challenge the status quo, are the ones who need this speech right. So basically, say you lived in Virginia before the Civil War, you could pass a law, as I think many southern states did, that there would be no incoming correspondence about slavery. Well, that's viewpoint neutral, but who is it really hurting? It's hurting the people who want to challenge the legality and the morality of slavery, not those who want to defend it. And that's the problem just in the broader picture with relying solely on viewpoint discrimination as your test, as the court did here. And there's actually a Harvard Law Review note that came out in November that says, yes, maybe the court got it right about viewpoint neutrality and discrimination, but that's too narrow a test for what happened to CLS here.
Sure. I think the comment that we know more about the court's views about employment provision versus Smith is really interesting. I hadn't picked up on that. I'd always sort of seen the CLS case in a way as an expression of the consequences of the sort of hydraulic pressure of employment division versus Smith. People really don't like Smith, right? Except for Justice Scalia, and apparently the court, for the time being. But, there's always been a lot of unease about it. We have the Religious Freedom Restoration Act at the federal level and, at state levels. I mean, there's some things about Smith that are hard to swallow. And one is that it appears to say that there would be no free exercise problem with a general and neutral public accommodations law forcing churches out in the general community to take whoever they wanted in their building. That, I agree, can't really be right. the court probably does too. But what CLS really wanted, in this case, is a recognition that for religious groups, there are really much better reasons to, say, discriminate on the basis of religious belief than other kinds of groups have. And so this is the sort of place where we ought to give religious groups a free exercise accommodation from the application of what is otherwise a neutral and generally applicable policy. And, that makes a lot of sense, but it runs right into employment division versus Smith, which then causes the issue to have to be litigated, in other ways and sort of press the boundaries of existing doctrine. A handful of really quick things. I mean, I respect the rhetoric, but it's not really fair, I think, to say that this case is about, schools wanting to exclude religious groups from campus or, wanting to kick CLS off campus. Hastings, never tried to do that. That's sort of much more the facts of Healy versus James, actually, where the university Gestapo busted into the campus coffee shop to try to bust up a group of students who were meeting informally. I think that maybe the subsidy lens that the court applies in the CLS case actually reflects maybe an implicit limitation on the holding. The court is saying, look, if they're setting up this separate RSO program that has, monetary subsidies associated with it and special status within the university community, like use of the university's name and whatnot, we're going to treat that as a limited forum issue, and we're going to, allow you to impose these limitations. I am not sure that that means that the court, has now committed itself to the idea that the entire campus is a limited public forum and that the university could thereby decree it is a condition of setting foot on the campus and being a student that you, you know, speak only about Plato or whatever. I mean, I really don't think the court means that. You know, I also don't think the court has decided the question of whether CLS could enforce its a membership requirement that was genuinely conduct-based of the sort that, you know, we won't take any student that engages in sex outside of the context of heterosexual marriage. That CLS has that policy. But that's not the policy that was litigated. CLS refused to sign the agreement with Hastings because they said in their letter, and it's a JA-281, that they wanted to be able to discriminate on the basis of religion and sexual orientation. If the case had been litigated against the backdrop of, you know, we having a apparently neutral conduct requirement that Hastings is forcing us to abandon, you know, it might have been a different case. I don't know. We'll see. Maybe that'll be the next case. Lastly, the question that's left open by CLS, the important question is, as Professor Laycock says, whether the school's written policy is viewpoint discriminatory. Of course, the school's written policy is framed in exactly the same language as Title VII and innumerable public accommodations in anti-discrimination laws across the country. So if it's facially viewpoint discriminatory, then so are they. I think Justice Stevens is basically right that the court's jurisprudence has always been that non-discrimination and public accommodations laws regulate conduct, not speech. And the fact that religion is in the list doesn't change that. And the fact that groups or individuals have viewpoint-based reasons for wanting to engage in the conduct of discrimination doesn't make a non-discrimination policy itself viewpoint-based. What CLS really wants, I think, here, really could achieve or could have achieved if the case had gone the other way, is not a holding that that policies framed this way are viewpoint discriminatory. I think that, if the court had wanted to rule for CLS, what it probably would have said is that we're going to add a new requirement to the list of things that you can't do in a limited public forum. I think the court probably would have said you can't discriminate on the basis of viewpoint. The condition has to be reasonable in light of the purposes of the forum. And now, for the first time, we're going to tell you that we're going to treat restrictions on expressive association the same way that we have treated viewpoint discrimination in the past, and you're not allowed to impose conditions that limit people's expressive associational rights. You know, that is a way the court could have gone, but that's not the same thing as saying that a restriction on discriminatory conduct is the same thing as a viewpoint restriction.